from KQED. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Mina Kim. Coming up on Forum, Washington Post reporter David Farenthold won a Pulitzer Prize this month for his relentless 2016 investigation into charitable giving by the Trump Foundation. And that Access Hollywood video of Trump bragging about groping women? Yes, Farenthold broke that story, too. He joins us to talk about his year covering Trump the candidate, and now he's now covering Trump the president. Then before the hour's up... We'll play along with that Facebook meme that's taken over people's feeds, 10 bands I've seen. We want to find out what concert was your favorite, for reals, no lies. Join us. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, this is Forum. I'm Mina Kim. I'm willing to bet that some of the stories you remember most from candidate Donald Trump's presidential campaign came from the Washington Post's David Farenthold. He's the reporter behind the story of Trump's 2005 Access Hollywood video where Trump bragged about sexually assaulting women. Farenthold's reporting also showed discrepancies between Trump's claims of charitable giving and his actual donations. Farenthold discovered Trump bought a portrait of himself with foundation money that was hung up at his golf course, and he uncovered the illegal contribution the foundation made to a Florida attorney general around the same time her office was considering an investigation into Trump University. Farenthold's efforts won him the Pulitzer Prize for national reporting this month. David Farenthold, thanks for joining us on Forum.
It's great to be here.
And congratulations on the Pulitzer Prize.
Thank you.
Incredible reporting. Really very well deserved. And it made me wonder how you even decided to start focusing on Trump's charitable giving during the campaign, because of all the angles and of all the stories swirling around Trump at that time. It's not like his foundation was necessarily, say, the splashiest story out there.
It was completely by chance. So I had spent a lot of 2015, the first part of the campaign, covering basically loser candidates, long shot candidates. Like, I spent 3 weeks writing about Bobby Jindal, if anybody remembers who Bobby Jindal is. And so the result was that all my candidates that I knew anything about had basically were kaput by the time that the Iowa caucuses even happened. So I had nobody to follow around Iowa. They said, okay, the editor said, go to Iowa and spend a day with Donald Trump. Because there's this weird thing about to happen, we think, where this guy who's been married three times and been on the cover of Playboy, he is going to maybe win the caucus in this very conservative state in Iowa. So I was watching Trump at an event in Waterloo, Iowa that day on caucus day, and I saw him at a rally. He stops the rally and he brings out a really big check, like a golf tournament size giant check that you can see from the cameras in the back. And he calls up a local veterans group from the audience and he says, local veterans group, I'm going to present you with this check for $100,000 from the Donald J. Trump Foundation. So the big check says Donald J. Trump Foundation on the top, on the bottom, Make America Great Again. So that caught my attention because that's basically illegal. You can't use your charity to boost your presidential campaign. Mm-hmm. And it got me interested in where was this money coming from? What was Trump doing? And it turned out that the money he was giving away was from this fundraiser he'd held a few days earlier where he skipped the Republican presidential debate because, believe it or not, he was feuding with Fox News. And he held a fundraiser for veterans. He said he raised $6 million for veterans, including $1 million out of his own pocket. So I came back from Iowa with just a simple question. What happened to that money? Where was the rest of it? I saw him give out $100,000. Where was the rest of it? And I thought that was going to be basically a two-day story because I thought, who would screw over veterans in the middle of a presidential campaign? But it wasn't. It turned into something that sort of snowballed and eventually occupied my entire year.
Yeah, lasted at least 9 months. You talked with Corey Lewandowski, who was the campaign manager at the time, and he essentially told you that the money that Trump had pledged had all been basically doled out?
This was an amazing phone call. This was May. So I spent the months after that time in Iowa trying all these different ways to figure out what had happened to the money, calling the Trump campaign, obviously, but calling veterans organizations. And I couldn't account for a lot of it. And especially I couldn't account for the $1 million that Trump said he'd given out of his own pocket. Then, as you said, Corey Lewandowski, who was Trump's campaign manager at the time, called me and he said, this is May 24th of last year. He said, Donald Trump has given away the $1 million. I can tell you that for sure. But I can't tell you who he gave the money to, which groups got the money, or what amounts, or when, or anything else. It's all secret. But you should just know Donald Trump gave the $1 million away. So, you don't want to just take it, you know, I can't just take his word for it, right? This is an important promise made by a guy who is making his love of veterans like a centerpiece of his campaign. I can't just take his word for it that he did this thing. So then I thought, okay, well, how do I check it, right? I can't prove a negative. I can't call every veterans charity in America and make sure that none of them got this money. I'll try to prove a positive. I'll try to find some of the money Donald Trump gave away. So I'll try to go out there and see if I can find, you know, even a little bit of that money. And then I could say, okay, well, I have some confidence the money was given away because, look, here's a charity that says they got part of it.
What prompted Trump to call you a nasty guy when you talked to him finally?
Well, that's the surprising thing out of that story. So after Lewandowski told me that Trump had given the $1 million away, I spent a day on Twitter asking different various veterans groups, disabled American veterans, veterans of foreign wars, you know, asking them on Twitter in public, you know, have you received any of this money? And including at real Donald Trump, Trump's handle in the queries. I did that for two reasons. One, I wanted the queries to get spread far and wide, to get retweeted so that maybe there was some group out there that got some of the money that I didn't even know about. And they might see the query go by and contact me and say, hey, we got the money. Or I know Donald Trump spends a lot of time searching for his own name on Twitter. I thought he'll see these queries and he'll go, okay, well, this guy's not taking my word for it. I'll just call and tell him where I gave the money away. Again, thinking that no way Donald Trump didn't give this money away. I just don't know where it is. So I spend a day tweeting in all these veterans groups and I don't find any of the money. Everybody that I contacted said, no, we never got anything. And what happened was that Donald Trump had not given the money away. The $1 million was still in his pocket. It was only that night after I spent this day querying veterans organizations looking for the money that Trump actually did give it away. And so he called me. Trump called me the next night to say, look, I gave this money away. He gave it all in one fell swoop, in one big check to this group called the Marine Corps Law Enforcement Foundation, which is a charity run by a friend of his. And I asked him, you know, why did it take you 4 months? You said 4 months ago you were going to give this money away. Why did it take you 4 months? Trump said, well, I had to vet the group. I had to vet this group before I was going to give them any money. And I said, I just happened to know that the group that Trump had given the money to, they had given him like a Man of the Year award at a black tie gala at the Waldorf Astoria the year before. So I said, you spent a whole night in black tie with these guys and you still had to vet them? And he said, oh, yeah, that's true. And then I said, well, did you just give this money away now because I was asking about it? You know, if I hadn't asked about it, would you never have given it away? And that is when he called me a nasty guy.
We're talking with David Farenthold, Washington Post reporter, who recently won the Pulitzer Prize for his investigative reporting on Donald Trump's claims of donations to charities. Farenthold's in town to speak at the Logan Symposium, which is hosted by the Investigative Reporting Program at UC Berkeley. In describing the way that you got Donald Trump to respond to you, that you were able to reach out to veterans groups, you've really been noted for the innovative ways you have used Twitter. And of course, one of the more famous examples now, or that's been shared a lot, is the way that you were able to figure out that he had bought a portrait of himself and that it had been hung up at one of his golf courses. Can you talk a little bit about the advantage of using Twitter and what you learned as a reporter in terms of using it in this way? Because it certainly wasn't necessarily the way most reporters would go about a story in progress.
Sure. Well, I had used Twitter in the past only as sort of another means of broadcasting. You know, here, I wrote this story. Here it is. My colleague wrote this story. Here it is. And here are my thoughts on whether the Nationals are going to win the World Series or whatever. I was not listening. I was only talking through Twitter. But through this experience, through this story covering Trump's donations, because Trump wouldn't help me at all, because he would give me almost no information, I was trying to find other ways to ascertain what he'd really done with regard to his charity. So what I learned was that you think, oh, I'm an investigative reporter. I'm a trained journalist. I dig up things all the time. I know every possible way there is to find out facts. But you don't. You're limited by your own experiences. You're limited by the systems you know, by the life experiences you've had. And what I found out was that by using Twitter to ask the public for help, to ask readers for help, you tap into all these people who have context and knowledge and connections that you could not even imagine. So you don't even know what you don't know until you ask these folks. So the painting is a great example. So I'll make this brief, but it's a fascinating story.
It is a great story.
So I should say at the outset, one of the key pieces of U.S. federal law about charities is you can't take the money in your charity and use it to buy things for yourself. If once the money's in a charity, it should be used for charitable purposes. So in 2014, we figured out Donald Trump had used the money in his charity, the Donald J. Trump Foundation, to buy a 4-foot-tall portrait of himself for $10,000. It actually was the second giant portrait of himself he bought with charity money. So we got a picture of it. I found the artist who had painted the picture that Trump had bought it from. And so I had a picture of the painting, but I didn't know where the painting was. And it's very important, obviously, legally, to understand where is the painting. Is it hanging in a children's hospital someplace, maybe serving a charitable purpose, or is it hanging on the wall of a sports bar that Donald Trump owns? So I put a picture up. On Twitter, I post this picture saying, this is the portrait I'm looking for. Now, before Twitter, how would I have figured out where that was? I could have gone to all the hotels and golf clubs Donald Trump owns and looked in all the corners and nooks and crannies. And I still might not have known for sure that it was where it was because maybe it was in his house in Trump Tower. I couldn't get in. But by putting it out there, a woman in Atlanta named Allison Aguilar, who's a short story writer who follows me on Twitter, she sees this painting and she has a thought that I didn't have, which was this painting. She thought this painting is so ugly that Donald Trump won't put it in his house. He's going to put it someplace where the public has to look at it. So she goes to the TripAdvisor page for the Trump golf course at Doral, this resort where the public can stay there. You know, so there's all these user-generated photos. There's, the hotel bathrooms. There's the 18th green, whatever.
Right.
350 photos in, she finds a picture of this portrait we're looking for hanging on the wall of the sports bar at the club.
So and clearly for his business, yes.
Right, exactly. There's no charitable, unless this place is called Champions. And so unless it's like a home for old racehorses, it's probably a business. So she tweets it at me and says, look at this. Now we know where the portrait was because the picture and TripAdvisor was dated February 2016. So like at 7 o'clock that night, I tweet that out. Oh, my God, look, Allison Aguilar found this picture that shows where the portrait was. Now where is it? Where is it now? At that time, there's a guy named Enrique Acevedo, who is an anchor at Univision, the national Spanish language TV network. And he sees that tweet. He realizes that Univision's studios are four blocks away from Doral. That he makes a reservation right then for that night. His newscast ends at midnight. He goes to the place, checks in, talks the cleaning crew into letting him into the sports bar, which is then closed, takes a picture of it. So we went from 10 o'clock that morning, having no idea where in the world this thing could possibly be, to 12:30 at night. Here's a picture of it on the wall breaking the law. That is just would have been impossible any other way than social media.
We're talking with David Farenthold, Washington Post reporter who broke the story about Access Hollywood, who covered relentlessly President Donald Trump's foundation and its, quote, charitable giving. And I'd like to invite you, our listeners, to join the conversation with your questions for David Farenthold. The number is 866-733-6786. Again, 866-733-6786. You can email your questions or comments to forum@kqed.org, post them on Facebook, on our website, kqed.org/forum, or on Twitter, @KQED Forum. This method, actually, it's even been called now. It's starting to be called the Farenthold method. Is it something that you would recommend all reporters do?
I think, there's a lot of cases where it doesn't work, right? There's a lot of cases where it's not applicable. But if you're dealing with a case where you're trying to make sense of a lot of data or you're trying to find a lot of disparate things and make sense of them, I think it's a fantastic method. And I think readers like it because they can see they like seeing sort of the process happen. They like seeing the search, the thing that makes journalism fun, sort of the hunt for things that you don't know. People like to see that going on. And also they respond, like I said, with tips and other things that help you do it.
Yes.
Just a good example of somebody applying it right now. There's a reporter named Christina Wilkie at the Huffington Post. And so last week she had this problem where the Trump Inaugural Committee had put out a listing of 1,500 of its donors, name, address, and a dollar amount. And she wanted to figure out, are these addresses and names correct? Are they bogus? Are some of them shell companies that are hiding the real donor? But 1,500 is a lot to go through. And so she got, with the help of one of my colleagues at the Washington Post, made a Google Doc, put it out there for the public to look at and said, readers, pick one of these things and go look up the answer and the name and the address and see if they match. In like 4 days, her team of volunteers had found, I think, 340 errors in this listing of 1,500 donors. The Trump Inaugural Committee had to admit that they did things wrong. And that was an amazingly fast digestion of this really complicated thing made possible by crowdsourcing.
You've also suggested that this method is also particularly useful for the type of president we now have. What do you mean by that?
Trump's MO has always been to keep as much about obviously, he's a very public persona, and one of the things he does a lot in public is promise to do things. He promised to be a, you know, to be a great negotiator, promised to give to charity, and all the promises he made on the campaign trail. But what he tries to do is to keep the information about whether he complied with those promises, whether he made good on them, he tries to keep that private. If he can't keep it private, he wants it to be really complicated. He wants it to make it effectively secret because it's so complicated to understand. And so that this method of reporting, this method of understanding, covering Trump means making maps. And I don't mean like maps of a city, but maps of data. You know, taking all these things that are out there in the world that are hard to make sense of, making sense of them. You know, who are his inaugural donors? What charities did he give to? All these things that he wants to make complicated, you can try to use the force of all these people to try to make maps and understand what he's actually doing. I think it's a particularly good way of covering Trump because he doesn't often have like a great He's not great at shaping his own narrative, but he's good at scattering all the data that helps you understand him.
It was all of this reporting that really got readers' attention and played a role in you being given the tip about the Access Hollywood video. Is that right? Can you talk about how that came in?
I can't say much about the source, but certainly, I mean, I was much, much better known by then. That was in October of 2016 than I had been at the beginning. So beginning of the year, I think I had like 4,500 Twitter followers. And at that point, I had 160,000. So I was much better known. And maybe that's why. So we got this video at about 11 o'clock in the morning on a Friday and knew almost instantly. It's a 5-minute video. We knew almost instantly what we had, that it was, you know, what a big deal it was because, I mean, as all your listeners know, this was not, we'd heard Trump before on the Howard Stern show sort of playing this over-the-top character where he'd like rape women's bodies and he'd say like, oh, I could have slept with Princess Diana, all these sort of outrageous things. But they were, you know, he had always excused them by saying, well, I was, you know, I'm playing a character and they're sort of speculative. I'm saying what I think, not what I do. That was what was different about this tape. You could tell in the beginning this was a guy not in public, in private, talking to his friend. And he's not just talking speculatively about women. He's saying, this is what I do. I grab them. This is what I'm about to do. This is woman we're about to meet is a soap opera actress. Maybe I'm going to grope her. You know, he puts the Tic Tac in. So we knew right away that it was a really big deal. And it was different even for Donald Trump. It was something that was beyond the pale of what we'd seen before. So we had the reporting process was basically we had to transcribe the video. We had to talk to our lawyers about whether we could use it. Had to cut off the second half of the video, which was a boring, you know, tour of the back lot for this soap opera appearance Donald Trump was going to do. And then we had to call a few people. We had to call Donald Trump. And so I sent the transcript of the sort of offending part of the videotape to his people.
It must have been fun to write. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, exactly. We had to send it to NBC because NBC owns Access Hollywood. We were worried they were going to beat us. You know, they may have had this video too. We were worried they were going to post it and beat us. But we had to take the risk and say, "You NBC, are you going to sue us because you believe this is your property? Are you going to say it's a hoax?" And you know, because the part where Donald Trump says all this stuff, you can't see his mouth moving. You just see the bus and you hear him. So, you know, you're going to say it's a hoax that this is not really Donald Trump's voice. And then we got to call Billy Bush and there's two women who are mentioned. One, Nancy O'Dell, who was Trump's, the woman at the beginning of the tape, Trump's talking about taking a woman furniture shopping. That's Nancy O'Dell. And then the soap opera actress. So we couldn't get anything out of Nancy O'Dell, the soap opera actress, or Billy Bush. They all didn't want to comment. The NBC people had their chance to say they were going to sue us and they didn't. They also no commented. Trump. And so at first we told them, okay, you have to have this thing. We're going to publish a story at 3:30 in the afternoon. At like 3, the Trump people get back to us and say, well, we've looked at this transcript. That doesn't sound like Donald Trump. And so we want to see the video. So after some hemming and hawing, the editors decided we'll send them the video. We sent them the video. We say, okay, now your deadline is 4. At 4 o'clock, we're confident in this story. We're going to publish it no matter what. You can say something or you cannot. At 4 o'clock, we hadn't heard from them. The editor's walking from my desk back to her desk, like 30 feet, to push the button and publish the story online. In the middle of that walk, and this is as close as you're going to get to like a dramatic stop the presses moment in a digital age, Trump called, or his aide called, Hope Hicks, his spokeswoman. She called and said, wait, stop. And so we didn't push the button. She said, we're going to send a statement. And the statement is one we all saw. It said basically, this was locker room talk. Bill Clinton said worse to me, but Donald Trump did it. This was – Donald Trump said this stuff. This is not a hoax. So we published it at 4:02 and NBC published theirs at 4:06. So we just barely beat them.
Wow. Well, a listener asks, scandal after scandal, then the Access Hollywood video. Was there ever a point you thought Trump's candidacy was done? Are you flabbergasted he won?
I never thought that the Access Hollywood video would do him in. I know a lot of people did, but I'd seen him survive other things. I thought maybe the consequence would be that it would drive other Republicans to finally renounce him, like Jason Chaffetz briefly did and a few others, and that Trump would – there'd be inter-Republican warfare that would dominate the last month of the campaign, which happened for a while. But then I think that Hillary Clinton didn't really use the Access Hollywood – didn't really use that revelation in a very effective way, and Trump kind of straightened out and flew right, and the effect of it, I think, dissipated, and then the Comey letter came. So I was flabbergasted that Trump won. On the, you know, my job the night of the election was to write the web lead-all story that would say Hillary Clinton won or Donald Trump won. And so you have to pre-write the – you know, you can't be sitting at 2 o'clock in the morning trying to compose a story. You have to pre-write a story for each of them. So I took the job of pre-writing the Donald Trump wins story at like 3 in the afternoon the day before when everyone thought Hillary Clinton was going to win. So I'm writing that story thinking like, oh, man, no one's ever going to believe I wrote a story saying Donald Trump was going to be president, and struggling for superlatives, like what a big surprise it would be if Donald Trump won. And then at 3 o'clock in the morning, you know, someone hit the button there. That story is now – was on our website. That was the, you know, that was the news.
Yeah. Well, we've got a lot of calls coming in. Let me try to get some. Let's go to Renee in South City. Hi, Renee.
Hi, good morning. Thank you for taking my call. So, first of all, I'd like to thank you very much for your excellent journalism and your dedication to finding the truth. But after that, my question is, what happens next? There seems to be so much media around and so many stories around Trump's sort of, let's say, untoward use of funds and other endeavors. And it seems to be that it just is the story, and then it goes on to the next story. And does anything happen as a result? Is anything getting passed on to any sort of legal body? Is he being prosecuted? I mean, as a layperson, I don't hear or read anything about this at all. And I'm wondering, is he being pursued legally for what he has done?
And what David revealed in his reporting, Renee, thank you. Yes. What have been the consequences so far of some of these things that you have been able to show in your reporting last year?
Well, my reporting specifically started this New York Attorney General investigation into the Donald J. Trump Foundation, this charity that Trump was using in ways that seemed to break the law.
What's the status
investigation
of it? Yeah.
Well, it's still going on. Trump has said he intends to shut it down, but he can't shut it down until the investigation is finished. It's not, as I understand it, the kind of investigation that would lead to a criminal charge. It probably would lead to the closure of the foundation, which he wants to do anyway, and some penalty taxes, fines, things like that. In some cases, he can be forced to give the money back to the original donors who gave it to him. But I don't know if it's going to reach that level. There are other far more serious legal things going on. I mean, To pick the most important one, I think, is the all the different investigations about Trump's involvement with Russia or possible involvement with Russia, Trump's campaign's involvement with Russia in the House and the Senate and the FBI. I don't know where those things are going to lead, but they certainly all seem to be active. I think, you know, the question about whether Trump is using money improperly or taking money improperly for his businesses, there's also some lawsuits going on there that we're definitely following.
We're talking with Washington Post reporter and Pulitzer Prize winner David Farenthold, who broke stories about candidate Trump's claims of charitable giving and reality, and also that infamous Access Hollywood video. We'll have more after the break with David Farenthold, but if you want to join the conversation, that number is 866-733-6786. Again, 866-733-6786. You can email us, forum@kqed.org, post your comments on our website, kqed.org/forum, or on Facebook or Twitter. We're at KQED Forum. And David Farenthold is in town and at UC Berkeley for the Logan Symposium, hosted by UC Berkeley's Investigative Reporting Program. You can also see him there. More after the break. This is Forum. I'm Mina Kim. You're listening to Forum. I'm Mina Kim. We're talking with Washington Post reporter David Farenthold about his year covering Trump, the candidate, and now he's now covering Trump, the president. He's here in town for the Logan Symposium hosted by the Investigative Reporting Program at UC Berkeley. And I know, David, that you need to get to a panel on that at 11. So we have about 15 minutes more with you. And so I want to get our listeners in. Wayne in Fairfield, California. Hi, Wayne.
Hi, good morning. Thank you for taking my call. David, I had a question for you related to your sources. With Trump attacking the media so often, what sort of concerns do you have about the reliability of your sources and how you're vetting them?
It's a really good question. I have not had the experience, thankfully, almost everything aside from the Access Hollywood story, almost everything last year that I reported on was from public sources. I mean, it was all on the record, interviews with charities, interviews with, you know, experts about charities, using documents that were in the public record. So I didn't worry about that much because everybody was doing their job out in public. Since then, you certainly do have greater concerns about you protecting sources. And I think we talk to sources who want to be quoted on background or, you know, not have their name used. You do a little more to make sure they understand the risks that they're taking, because you don't want to sort of lead people into some putting themselves in jeopardy but they don't understand that. And I certainly pay attention to cybersecurity much more than I did, using two-factor authentication, using password protectors, things like that, and sort of in thinking about where I put data and how vulnerable it is. That's the thing that worries me the most, actually, is the Russians will hack us or other news organizations. The interesting thing about sourcing is that about the Trump White House. I don't cover the White House that much day to day, but it's been interesting watching them. That in the old days, which means before the Trump administration, if a named administration official was going to go on television with their name and face and say something, you could pretty much assume that it was true, right? If they were stating facts on television with their name attached, it was true. And that is actually not true at all in this case. In fact, often what leaks is usually more true than what people say on television, because the inside White House folks who are speaking on television are often speaking directly to Trump through the television, and they're using that to sort of tell him what they want him to know, or, you know, to have him hear that they're defending him. So it's been harder to sort through within the White House, even their official on-the-record communications, what's true and what's not.
Well, I want to thank Wayne for the question and go to Melissa in San Jose. Hi, Melissa.
Hi. Thank you so much for taking my call. And David, just want to say we really appreciate your reporting and hope it continues. My question has something to do with what the caller previously asked about when Donald Trump would go and do speaking events and take speaking fees. And in lieu of receiving this money would go to the foundation. Why is this not seen as tax evasion? And, you know, I would hear it getting reported about, but not, you know, what would happen afterwards. Is this something that's being investigated? And I'll take the comments off air. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Melissa.
Thank you for reading that. That was one of the things we reported last year, was a lot of the contributions to Trump's, you know, he lists in his IRS filings to the Trump Foundation contributions from people. It's particularly a guy who is like a ticket broker in New York, somebody who is a sort of high-end reseller of tickets to concerts and things like that. And it appeared that guy, he was giving these big but odd number donations to the Trump Foundation, $558,432 to the Trump Foundation. And what it turned out was that guy was somebody who had a business relationship with Trump, I think reselling Trump's tickets to the U.S. Open, the tennis open. And Trump said, don't pay me, pay my foundation instead, which as the caller noted, that is – you can do that, but that counts as income and you have to pay income taxes on it merely because you divert it to your foundation. If Trump still controls where the money goes, he must pay income taxes on it. So our question to the Trump campaign was, did he pay income taxes on this? And at first they sent out this guy, Boris Epstein, who is a spokesman for the Trump campaign and briefly at the White House, basically to lie to me, to tell me that Trump had never done that. He said, Trump has never directed money owed to him to his charity. And I said, are you sure? And he said, well, prove me wrong. And I said, what about this time? Okay, that one time. And it turned out there were a number of other cases where he'd done that. So that is part of the investigation by the New York Attorney General's office. It's possible the IRS will also investigate that. But one of the disappointing things I learned in this reporting was how little the IRS does to follow up on charity allegations, charity problems, and in particular how politicized the IRS has become. So the willingness to take on somebody like a candidate Donald Trump or a president Donald Trump is basically nil.
Melissa, thanks for the question. Scott writes, it's important to not trivialize the foundation scandal with language like discrepancies. That was actually a word that I used earlier. Trump and his foundation staff lied. David Farenthold, would you go as far to say lied?
The word lie is always problematic for us because it implies intent, you know, that somebody understood what they were doing and purposely did it wrong. It's possible that Trump's many, many problems with his foundation are due to sheer incompetence. He, over the course of 20 years, he paid a total of $250 in legal fees over a period of 20 years. So he did not have great legal counsel. But there was one particular thing that – or maybe he had really efficient legal counsel. He only needed, you know, 1 minute per year. One of the things that made me think that there was an effort, a possible effort to deceive, was you mentioned earlier this contribution for the Trump Foundation to Pam Bondi, who was the attorney general in Florida.
Right.
She was – her office was considering whether to join an investigation against Trump University. At that time, she solicits a $25,000 campaign contribution from Trump. He gives it. He pays it out of his foundation, which, again, that's illegal. You can't do. And then when the Trump Foundation reports that year to the IRS, here are the donations we gave – they basically covered up that foundation. The Pam Bondi's campaign committee was called And Justice for All, and based in Florida, obviously. When they reported to the IRS, the Trump Foundation told the IRS they'd given the group called to a group called Justice for All, that's an anti-abortion nonprofit in Kansas. So it was they said, "Oh, there's a big book of foundations." We got it all confused, basically to believe that they weren't intentionally trying to deceive the IRS and cover up this illegal contribution. You had to believe they were like seven levels of incompetence, seven different independent errors made along the way. That's very suspicious, but because I'm not then, I can't tell you that they did it on purpose.
You know, you got death threats after the story about the Access Hollywood video. Am I right? It was that story that prompted a threatening call to your news organization?
Yes. So I should say I did not get nearly as much sort of vitriol, death threats, as a lot of other reporters did, especially the female reporters who were out on the trail with Donald Trump. I think possibly because my name is so hard to spell. It's harder to insult me because you have to spell it right first. But there was one case where right after the Access Hollywood video on a weekend day, somebody called me, a guy from Milwaukee called me, and he got to the sort of automated attendant at the Post, slurred my name into the automated voicemail and got directed to a guy in sports, Des Beeler, not me, because the computer couldn't understand him. But then he helpfully left a death threat on that guy's voicemail for me. And so the FBI, the Post responded very forcefully. They got me a security consultant to make my house more secure, to change my habits in case this guy was serious about it. The FBI went out and talked to the guy. So it changed my life a lot. Right afterward, but everybody on my end reacted very seriously to it. And I think it was just one. There was other people got a lot more in a lot of forums.
Well, I guess what it's making me think about is in many ways you are a story now, right? Your name, when I Google you, for example, right? It's not like it just comes up with the stories you've written. You are the headline. You're telling the behind-the-scenes story of your year covering Trump. David Barenthold congratulates high school, you know, journalism team on it. What does it mean to you that you are the story?
Well, it's wonderful, first of all. I feel like I love journalism. I love being a reporter. And the chance that this has given me to go talk about what I do and how much fun I find it and try to encourage people to do it and read it and buy it, it's wonderful. The other thing for me is that I feel a lot of responsibility to sort of uphold the ideals of journalism. If I'm going to be somebody who's a well-known journalist, I want to show people what a journalist ought to be. And just to give you one good example, this is kind of a trivial example, but when I have on social media, when I'm on television or on the radio, I always want to show people how open I am to Donald Trump's perspective, right? I'm not out to get Donald Trump. I didn't get into this to show Donald Trump's a bad person. A lot of the reporting is aimed at trying to tell Donald Trump's side of it. He says he gave all this money to charity. He says he did this and that. Did he really do it? And so it's important for me not to sort of – to show people like I haven't prejudged Donald Trump. I'm still open to him and his supporters. And I try to go to great lengths to be sort of open and optimistic and to show that to people in my public persona.
What is – if you had to characterize him or tell us the picture of Trump that's emerged from all your reporting, how would you coin it?
Well, I think there's a couple of lessons. One is about sort of his moral character and the way he views philanthropy, which was that he clearly knew that being a rich person in public, there was an expectation. The public expected that he would be philanthropic. He would give some of that money away. He understood that, and he wanted to satisfy the public expectation. That's why he made all these sort of public promises to give money away. But in private, he did as little as possible to comply with sort of the substance of those promises, to basically actually be philanthropic, to give away some of himself to help others. In fact, he went to great lengths to give of other people's money to help himself. So he wanted that appearance but didn't want to do anything in private to sort of really be philanthropic. I think that's an important insight about him. The other thing is an insight I think that applies – you can see it coming true in his presidency, which is that he's not a strategic thinker. He's not somebody who picks a long-term objective and does things that serve that long-term objective. And you could see it in his charity in that what the Donald J. Trump Foundation gave away, it was mostly other people's money, but he was giving it away. It didn't – there was no central theme. There was no college or, you know, a medical charity or some cause that he was really interested in that he gave a lot of money to. He sort of gave here and there all because of personal relationships and short-term needs. Okay, my buddy's going to be honored at this gala for the Less Than Such Society. I'm going to give money to that society just enough to sort of, you know, cover me for that event. And so he spreads his money all around in all these different places to satisfy these sort of short-term relationship needs with no strategy. The result is at the end of it all, he's given away a lot of other people's money. I looked for like monuments to him. You know, what did charities name after Donald Trump? Was there a building or a wing or a library or whatever? Mm-hmm. I found a theater seat in New Jersey, a theater seat in Florida. Not a theater, a seat in the theater with his name in the back, and a park bench in New York. That was it. Like the entire charitable legacy could fit in the back of a U-Haul. And that you see that in his presidency now, that he's not able to follow long-term goals. He deals with short-term relationships and lets other people dictate what he'll spend his time on. I think we're seeing that happen a lot, especially in the last couple of weeks.
Well, let me see if I can get one last call in from Bonnie in Santa Rosa before we have to let you go. Hi, Bonnie.
Hi there. Thank you so much. And Mr. Farenthold, thank you for your work. You're a fascinating guy, and I pray for your good health.
Thank you.
Well, Bonnie, thanks for sharing that. And this has come up a lot, David, so I just want to ask this of you one more time. A listener asks, is David disappointed that after exposing so much questionable activity in Trump's charitable giving that he was still elected? I think I remember you, David Farenthold, talking about a German reporter saying, do you feel like it was all for naught? Where are you with that?
That's true. I was asked by a German reporter after the election, was it all for nothing? Does it not matter? Did you not matter at all? I don't think about it that way at all for two reasons. One, the elections are big, big things with lots of factors, including the other candidate, right? So, you know, I reported a lot about Trump. I told you a lot about Trump, but I never thought I was the factor that was going to shape this huge election, which thousands of people were involved in. So, you know, I think something like the Comey letter, which came out right before the election and was a real reference to something that really happened in a mistake of judgment that Hillary Clinton made, I think that had a big impact. The fact that that had an impact doesn't mean that my stuff had no impact or wasn't important. That's one thing. The other thing is, you know, right. So like at 3 o'clock in the morning and the night of the election, when we finally posted our story saying Donald Trump won, I got this email from a reader that was like, ha ha, you lost. We won. And it's like, don't feel bad for me. Donald Trump is a gift to journalism, right? We have never had more people interested in Washington journalism and what we do than we do right now. So, you know, to you, you know, to that guy, the Trump viewer, I was like, okay, you support Trump. It's on you to help him. But don't feel bad for me. This is like a full employment act for journalists. So, you know, I feel like it's given us, you know, a lot to write about and a lot of an audience. You know, we can't try to control the news, but it's certainly given us an opportunity now to sort of show people why we matter.
And now you are part of the Washington Post team looking at potential conflicts of interest for Trump.
That's right.
Well,
so we look at the golf courses, hotels, things like that.
And the emoluments clause. We'll
and the emoluments clause, that's right.
Well, David Farenthold, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me on.
David Farenthold, Pulitzer Prize-winning Washington Post reporter, spent a year covering Trump the candidate, and now he's living Trump the president.